listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. This year is the centennial of the birth of William Burroughs, original cult figure of the Beat movement, and we'll celebrate Burroughs' legacy with Beat historian and biographer Barry Miles and LA Times book critic David L. Ulan. Miles' new book is the first full-length biography of Burroughs to be published in a quarter century, and the first to chronicle the last decade of Burroughs' life and examine his long-term cultural legacy. I caught my own glimpse of William Burroughs in the mid-70s at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, where Burroughs reunited with his spectacularly messed-up son, Billy. If you ever heard Burroughs speak, and I'm sure many of you have heard him speak in recordings or in person, as he did in Ann Waldman's poetry seminar that year at Naropa, you never forgot the sepulchral sound of his voice or the strange discordance between the fashion tastes of those in his entourage and his own penchant for dressing in three-piece Brooks Brothers suits. William Burroughs was the scion of the Burroughs Adding Machine family. He graduated with honors from Harvard, but his life followed no conventional path from there. It included a brief stint in Vienna to study medicine, a gig as a private detective, a brief period of employment as a pest exterminator, a drug bust in New Orleans. There's morphine, Times Square, the accidental murder of his wife, naked lunch, a marijuana farm in Texas, Tangiers, Mexico, Soft Machine, his fellow Beats, Nova Express, Columbia, life on the Bowery in a former YMCA locker room, a role in Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy, his role as a revered progenitor of punk, and his final years in Lawrence, Kansas, where he died at 83. Didn't seem like someone who would be a candidate for a long life, but there he was. Strong as an ox, Barry says. You'll hear about some of that extraordinary and certainly controversial life and literary legacy tonight from Barry Miles, who takes a panoramic view of the 20th century as he follows Burroughs on his wild ride. Barry Miles has had a long association with the London Underground of the 1960s as both participant and chronicler. He's been a close friend to many influential artists, including William Burroughs. He's the author of many seminal works on popular culture, including the authorized biography of Paul McCartney, plus Ginsberg, a biography, an earlier Burroughs bio called El Hombre Invisible, Jack Kerouac, King of the Beats, and The Beat Hotel, Ginsberg, Burroughs, and Corso in Paris. He also co-edited the revised text edition of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. David Ulan, whom we know as the LA Times book critic, is the author of two books and from 2005 to 2010 was its books editor. He's also the co-curator of Writing California, a conference that we're hosting here in association with the USC Institute on the West at the end of the month, and we have information on that on our website. We hope you'll join us. David was able to interview William Burroughs in Lawrence, Kansas in April 95, the year that LACMA's exhibition of Burroughs' paintings was put up. He also wrote an astute and personal afterword to the 50th anniversary edition of Burroughs' nightmare novel, or non-novel, Naked Lunch, in which he reminds us of the book's skewed visionary aspects. Burroughs, he wrote, is not reading the future as much as he is explicating the present, and in so doing, tracing a cultural counter-history. Please enjoy this evening, and please welcome Barry Miles and David Ulan. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. Thank you guys all for coming. We're going to talk for about 45 minutes or so, and then I believe we will actually listen to a little bit of Mr. Burroughs, and then we will turn it over to questions from you guys. There may be some photographs at some point. Are they there now? Do we want to just identify? Well, it's obviously William Burroughs. Do you want to talk about
William Burroughs?
I
don't know who that is.
That's John Waters.
No.
We can skip over that. So we're going to have, I said when we were doing the sound check that this conversation could easily go on for about 6 or 8 hours. So we will sort of try and compress it into 45 minutes or so. This is the book. As Louise said, it is the first. It's the first full-length Burroughs biography since the Ted Morgan book.
Yep.
And that book, which came out in the late 1980s, about 10 years before Burroughs died. So it's really the first Burroughs biography to encompass the totality of his life. Why don't we start with just a little bit of personal background. You met Burroughs in, you were saying, in 1965. Can you talk about the circumstances by which you came into his sphere?
Yeah, there was a sort of underground scene in London. A lot of my friends knew Burroughs from either the Beat Hotel in Paris in like 59, 60, 61. Others knew him from his earlier years in London from about 60 through to about 64. But I was a bit younger than those guys, and I didn't connect up with him at that point. But in 64, I began corresponding with him. By then, he was living in Tangier, and I wrote asking him for manuscripts for various underground, you know,
this
anthologies.
This is International
and so
Times.
No, it's a little bit before then. This is literary. You know, the era of the little literary magazine, basically. And then he left Tangier. He went to New York for about 7 months, 8 months. When he returned, instead of going back to Tangier, he moved back to London. And that was when I finally met up with him. It was September 1965. And I knew him pretty well through his ex-boyfriend or on-off boyfriend, Ian Somerville, who introduced us. And Ian was responsible for the Dream Machine and all kinds of aspects of the kind of collaborations of the sort of Burroughs experimental circle, shall we say.
Right. And that was the height of Burroughs' experimentalism in certain sense. The tape cut-ups, the film projects. He was working with Anthony Balch at that point, or starting to work with Anthony Balch at that point. So that was a pretty vibrant period. He was still doing literary work, but he was very much involved in what we might call a sort of artist psychic investigation in some sense, right? Can you talk a little bit about what all those processes entailed?
Well, Burroughs never really left the magical kingdom. He was one of those children who had visions, and he saw faces in the wallpaper. And his mother claimed to be clairvoyant and encouraged him in this rather than try and set him straight and say this is, you know. And he came from a privileged background. He was always surrounded by servants. His parents gave him $200 a month until he was 50 years old. So he never had to deal with everyday reality. He never had, you know. So he was able to stay at least part in the magical kingdom that most children grow out of at the age of four or five. Right. And so, and the older he got, the more he believed in it. I mean, when he was in Tangier, he was fascinated by their belief in magic. And during the period we were talking about in Paris in the late 50s.
This is the Beat Hotel period.
The Beat Hotel period, when he was living in the building along with, first of all, Ian Somerville and Brian Gyson. Ginsberg was there for a while as well, in the earlier part of that.
And Gregory Corso.
I mean, the whole, it was very much a beat centre. And particularly through Gyson, he began to investigate psychic phenomena, the different ways of becoming invisible, for instance, and a lot of crystal ball gazing. I mean, literally, the old-fashioned crystal ball, where you would stare and stare and stare, and in the end, great clouds of smoke would appear and in the ball, and you'd see wonderful visions.
Well, I want to. I mean,
usually with the aid of some hashish, mind you.
I'm sure that will always help with the vision. I want to just sort of jump in for a minute because I think one of the things that's fascinating about the story and is in the book is that you that there were manifestations that appear to be real or were inexplicable, right? You tell the story about him being arrested in Paris and the police taking him in and taking his photograph and nothing coming up on
That's right.
That they had to, they took a photograph three times before they could actually get an image.
Yeah, yeah.
And as he said, that was him working his working
not,
magic.
Not
right?
For nothing am I known as El Hombre Invisible.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And that also, whatever the experiments were that they were doing, you know, that there were people who would not go into Burroughs' room, right? That they would they would see phenomena that they couldn't explain and they would just stay away. So is your own sense, as someone who isn't living in the magical kingdom, what is your sense of this? I mean, do you think that there's real reality to or the potential for real reality to this?
Logically,
didn't think we were going to go here this quick.
Logically, I don't believe it. But I would imagine Bill is capable of summoning up, you know, all kinds of weird impressions in people. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it was really just a circus trick. I mean, there was one occasion in the Beat Hotel in about 1959 when Ian Somerville went around and told all their friends living there and just regular residents that Burroughs was going to conduct an experiment and become invisible. And he gave everybody a little block of hash as well, about an hour before the performance, so that helped. Right. And then basically it was Burroughs sitting behind a couple of screens, and they were projecting a photograph of him onto it. And it was going in and out of focus, and sometimes focusing on Burroughs and sometimes on the screen. And in the end, you didn't know whether you were looking at the picture of Burroughs on the screen or Burroughs himself. And at one point he slid down to the floor, and the projections continued. And no one in the audience knew that he'd gone. He crawled out. And then suddenly, you know, they put the light on, and he was gone.
Right.
But that's just a regular conjuring trick. Really.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
But it's probably felt, you know, pretty impressive at the time.
Yeah. Now, your first experience working with him was basically cataloging his archive, doing a bibliography.
Yes, I knew him from... from 65, but I didn't really get to be friends with him until 1972 when he asked me to catalogue his archive. And we worked together on and off for about 7 months, and if you added it all up, it's probably about 4 months solid work. Mm-hmm. And every day we would go through his archives, and he didn't eat much in the way of lunch, but after checking his watch at exactly at 6 o'clock, he would start to pour these industrial-sized whiskers, and I mean, it was too much for me. I used to have to go and throw up before we went out to dinner because I could barely walk and certainly talk.
Whereas he
carried on, you know, just the absolute trencherman. It was astonishing.
Right. By the time I encountered him, the time had crawled up to about, I think, 3 or 3:30. Oh,
right, yes,
that
yes.
When we,
no, it
when,
moved
that
back
was when the drinking started.
It moved back, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about, and you've also, you know, I'm curious about the idea of sort of pulling out to write a biography like this, of a figure who you not only knew over a long period of time and knew well over a long period of time, but also worked with in a very close way in that sense. I mean, cataloging someone's archive is a fairly intimate process, right?
Mm.
Was that a challenge in terms of pulling back and trying to assess the broad range of his life in a book like this?
Yes, I mean, the kind of books I write, I try not to be subjective at all. I mean, it's impossible, of course, but I figure that if his behavior is reprehensible, it's not up to me to say that. The reader can figure that out.
Yeah.
So I've tried to be even-handed about all of these things. But certainly working with him, for instance, you do see... the best example would be when I was cataloguing the papers. As I was going through, there was one huge pile of papers tied up in string, and on the top it said, bottom of the barrel. And it must have been about at least 2,000 pages of manuscript.
Right.
And as I went through it, there was a whole sequence of pages which had numbers on them, and they were building into a proper manuscript, fully numbered manuscript. And I showed it to him and asked what it was, and he said, he literally blanched, and he said, "That's queer." And this was a book that in previous interviews, he'd even denied that ever existed.
Right.
And,
it was something of a mythic book in his.
It was a mythic book, and it
work,
didn't. Yeah. And eventually got published in 1984, I think, or six or something. But it reminded him so much of that period in Mexico City when he was living with Joan Vollmer and had the accident, the shooting accident in which he killed her.
Right.
So this was something he just did not want to deal with. So. You know, so I realized that this is something he didn't want to deal with, and put it in a folder, and off it went to the archive.
Right, and then was ultimately 10 or 12 years later was ultimately published.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you guys all? I mean, I'm assuming most of you know these references. Like, do you know the Joan Vollmer story, the story of his wife, the shooting death in Mexico City? So we should probably tell that story. I suppose it is the. Probably the centerpiece of the Burroughs, both of the Burroughs' myth in some sense, good for good or ill, and also he saw it as sort of the definitive, in the introduction to Queer, he writes about it, that very famous introduction, he writes about it as sort of the beginning of his writing life in some way, that he'd been writing his way out of that experience ever since it happened. Do you want to tell the story?
Yes, he'd gone down, he was living in Mexico City with Joan and their two children. She had a daughter by a previous marriage and she had a son with William. But Burroughs had always been gay and she'd always tolerated his boyfriends, and he had just come back from a visit to South America with the latest sort of erstwhile boyfriend, who was in fact just some kind of hustler who was certainly didn't reciprocate Bill's affection. And 2 days, I think, after they got back, Bill was walking down the street having delivered a knife to be sharpened and found his cheeks just running with tears. And he knew something was really wrong, but he was unable to bring it to consciousness. And so he went back to the apartment and started to drink, as you would. And Joan, in the meantime, who was also an alcoholic and who used to start drinking at about 8 a.m. and sipping tequila just slowly through the day, had already gone on to a drinks party. And this is by now, we're talking the early evening, up past 6, 7 o'clock. So they were both really drunk at this drinks party, which was in the room above an expat bar called the Bounty Bar. And at some point in this relatively crowded party, Burroughs said, "Let's do our William Tell act." And Joan picked up a whiskey glass and put it on her head. And he whipped out his gun, and he always had a gun with him. And he fired and hit her right on the hairline instead of hitting the glass. And, of course, I mean, she slumped to the floor. Burroughs began, tore his hair out. But as he told me once when we were discussing this, it's something he talked about quite a bit with his friends, that even if he'd hit the glass, it was madness. It was complete act of insanity, because there would have been shards of glass flying around a crowded room, and just as dangerous. And he recognized that there was something in him that he had to get rid of. There was this something that he later on identified as the ugly spirit. In fact, it was identified during one of these trance sessions at the Beach Hotel with Brian Gyson, and Gyson was in some kind of state, having stared at the crystal ball or something, and read out a sentence of "the ugly spirit killed Joan," and Bill was very pleased in the sense that at least this entity had been identified and had a name, and he could now concentrate his activities on expelling it from his person. But being a writer, he used it as a metaphor for many other things, that the ugly spirit was part of his privileged aristocratic background. So he identified it with the robber barons and, that sort of group of people that he grew up around. I mean, one of his uncles was Ivy Lee, for instance, the inventor of PR, whose clients was the German Nazi Party. So you're dealing with some pretty dodgy people here.
There's a great line in the book where he says, "I was talking last time I talked to Hitler. He said I don't have anything against the Jews."
That's right.
so yes, this is his background. But it's interesting because I think the ugly spirit as a sort of metaphor, let's say, if nothing else. I mean. You begin the book with a set piece from the early 1990s where there was a sweat lodge ceremony in Kansas to try and exorcise the ugly spirit. So it was something that he felt was with him for the duration of his life.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
But the ugly spirit, it dovetails very well with sort of his theories of control, his theories of addiction, this notion of sort of, every man has some kind of parasitic entity inside them that is not always operating in his or her best interest.
This is true. Yeah.
So all of those things kind of dovetail in a certain way. Yeah, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that that sense of kind of control and addiction that really did drive him, that he that he really was writing against in a certain sense.
Well, he did feel that there was this side of himself which had caused him to kill Joan, and he felt that the only way he could identify it and it was through writing, and that would put him in contact with it. And in his investigations into control systems, because he was a writer, I mean, there were many imaginative sort of asides and uses. I mean, sometimes he would identify it with time, life, and that kind of empire of images and words that were controlling people. Other times, he would look at words themselves, and eventually he came up with a sort of general theory in which words themselves, the language that you grow up with, it contains within it all these instructions and control systems, a whole set of received information that you unconsciously absorb and believe in without questioning any
this
of it.
This is the language as a virus idea.
Language as a virus. And so he said that you should, in various different ways, that you should question everything. You should question your nationality, you should question patriotism, your religion, your parents, your education system. And if you found it okay, fine, but at least then it was your idea and not something that you had unconsciously absorbed and just were parroting. And so in that respect, I mean, I think he's still extremely relevant because of, in our surveillance society and, you know, the massive controls of advertising and all the rest of it going on at the moment, I mean, more than ever, Burroughs' message is a good one, I think.
Oh, I think, and I think actually at this point, the idea that language somehow shapes or constructs reality is a fairly mainstream idea, right? I accept it as an article of faith. I mean, it reminds me that there's one of my favorite quotes of his is a line from The Job where he says, "You must learn to live alone with, what is it, no religion, no allies, no country. You must learn to exist alone in silence," which is an interesting sort of ethos for a writer to express, that idea of moving away from language, moving towards a kind of silence.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it took him into a number of areas. I mean, in a way, that's why he got into the visual arts as well, because he believed that if you could get back to the original pictographic forms of language, then it was more obvious what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the concept of cut-ups that he got through Brian Gyson, in which, certainly in its initial phases, was literally reading between the lines. Brian Gyson rediscovered the cut-up technique by when he was mounting some drawings and using his Stanley knife to cut through the mounting board, and he was protecting the table with a pile of newspapers. And then he realized, as the newspapers peeled back, that he could read other lines through the gaps. And he found it so amusing. I mean, he was laughing so loud that his neighbor in the next room in the hotel knocked on the door, thinking he was having a hysteria attack. Because he was like literally on the floor, like chuckling. Burroughs, when he was introduced to it, saw the humor of it, but he also saw the seriousness of it. He thought, this is a way of seeing what people are really saying, and immediately started to cut up his own material and everybody else's.
And also folding in, right? cutting in the work of other writers. Right?
Well, they very quickly realized that, yeah, you don't physically cut it up. I mean, you just cut the page into four, maybe, and then trim the margins, and you can just move these blocks of text. And he would usually, from one block of text, he would maybe produce two lines, mm-hmm. you know, maybe at the most, which he would then type out. And then even then, the page he typed out, he might cut up that. So in the end, sometimes they got pretty far removed from anything that might be regarded as a regular sort of linear sentence. The earliest cut-up book, I mean, proper full-length book, is The Soft Machine, which a lot of people do find that first edition difficult to read. And to me, it's actually one of his most beautiful books because some of the imagery is just totally poetic. And later on, unfortunately, he tried to make it more commercial and he introduced regular narrative.
And I think for that book, you always, for me at least, I had to teach me how to read it. I had to give up a sense of trying to find a narrative in it and just give myself over to the sort of the imagery of the language.
It's like Knightwood or some of those. I mean, it's like high modernism, really. Yeah. I mean, he's almost on the cusp there between, he's really much more in the tradition of you know, the wasteland, and
right, or even
or the waves or something. I mean, you know, it's astonishing.
Now, this raises an interesting question in his career because, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating is that Naked Lunch predates the cut-ups, but in some ways, Naked Lunch embodies the cut. I mean, it's almost as if, and I'm not saying that he was that there's a psychic force there, but it's almost as if Naked Lunch predicts the cut-ups in some way, or that he was ready for the cut-ups. When I first read Naked Lunch, having heard of the cut-ups but not knowing the history, I assumed that some of the wilder stuff in Naked Lunch was the product of that of that process of creation. But that didn't evolve until Naked Lunch was already out, right? The Gerodius edition had already been published.
Yes. Well, the Gerodius edition was Bill's final sort of working of the text. There was a lot of publicity over, it's a complicated story, but Gerodius wanted to catch hold of a lot of publicity that was going on in the States about... Right.
Maurice Gerodius was ran Olympia Press, which published an English language publisher in Paris, which published sort of erotica, but also published a lot of literary fiction that was not able to be published in the United States and England, including the first editions of Naked Lunch and Lolita, among
That's right.
And The Ginger Man.
And The Ginger Man, and Henry Miller, and Beckett, all kinds of people. But mostly he published pornography, of course. I mean, he was in it for the money.
Alex Troche tells the story of him turning in young Adam and having Gerodius say, "You got to sex it up."
That's right. Yes.
Anyway, I'm sorry. So let's talk about the Gerodius, the Olympia Press edition.
There was publicity in Chicago because a local college magazine had been criticized by a gossip columnist, and it had all turned into a whole big censorship event. And Gerodius wanted to get Naked Lunch out. He'd already turned it down twice, but now he thought this is the time to do it and sell lots of copies, and but the manuscript by then had been sort of dispersed really, and lots of parts of it Burroughs wanted to rewrite, so he was rewriting bits, and Brian Gyson and Sinclair Bellis and several other friends came in and began to type it all up. Burroughs was a terrible typist, so he didn't do fine, you know, the final draft of any of it. And in fact, most of the time Naked Lunch was being put together, he was taking some quite strong marjoun and firing his gun at a set of photographs that he pasted on the wall. So he had very little hand in that.
Right.
And as these people finished each section, it would be sent off to the typesetter, and Sinclair Bellis literally would run off with it. When they all came back, Burroughs had a look at it, and he moved one section, which is the Hauser and O'Brien section, which are two cops who feature in one of the sections, so that the book was framed by them. It begins and ends with them. And the rest of it, he said, this looks fine. And so he just left it in the completely random order that it had come back from the typesetter. In fact, there were several bits which had gotten typed up twice. And when James Grauholtz and I... did the final edition, final edit of the thing not too long ago, the revised text edition. Burroughs had told me that the duplication was not intended. It was a complete accident, so we actually took those out again. Right. So, but the American edition is actually an earlier draft, because after the Olympia one came out, that Burroughs was the only one that Burroughs had actually signed off on. Grove wanted a bigger book when they came to publish it, and Allen Ginsberg
bigger as in more pages,
bigger as literally in more pages. And Allen Ginsberg had an earlier draft, and Burroughs wrote and told him, put this, you know, he wants it to be, you know, he can add some of the material from the earlier draft, but make sure it's in the same order as the Olympia book because he liked the Olympia edition. But unfortunately, Allen left the. Instead of having the Olympia edition retyped, retypeset, he literally used the earlier manuscript, and there were a lot of changes in there. We made over 3,000 small changes, almost all of them punctuation or to do with first person into third or third into first.
So that was the version. The Ginsberg version was the version that gave Kerouac the nightmares when he was typing it up in
Tangier.
Right?
That's right. Yes.
And so when you did the. The restored edition.
That's what it's called. You're right.
Right.
Yeah.
How did that? What was that process like in terms of? Did you make any? Was it even worth making an attempt to sort of regularize the Olympia edition and the Grove edition, or was it really just focused
on
the Grove?
Well, I mean, ideally, one would have simply corrected all the spelling of the Olympia edition and put that out because Burroughs did sign off on that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, by then, a lot of the American edition had been quoted in scholarly texts, and you know, you don't want to tamper with the canon too much, you know, because people will look up something, they'll look for their favorite bit, and it's gone because we've taken it out. You know, I mean, you
just Dr. Benway.
So we had to make basically a third edition, and this is typical of Burroughs because all his books are fugitive like this. I mean, there never seems to be a final draft of any of them. The Soft Machine he rewrote twice, and the three editions are completely different.
First, and they were all published. Yeah.
And they were all published. The first one was the Olympia edition in Paris. Then it was published here by Grove, who well, he rewrote at least 60 pages of straight narrative for it. And then after that, when the English edition came out from John Calder, he rewrote it yet again. Mm-hmm. And that's really quite a different text. In fact, very, very different. And by then, he'd already done The Ticket That Exploded in coming from Olympia Press in Paris. For the Grove edition, he rewrote that and tried to make that more commercial.
Right.
And all of these were collaborations as well. This is the thing about Burroughs' writing, is that inevitably there are a team of people working on it with him, helping to type it up or to edit it or knock it into some kind of shape. Much later on, he worked with James Grauholtz, who was his ex-lover, close friend, business manager.
And who still administers the estate.
And who's now, yes, who is the literary executor, runs the estate, is the adopted son. I mean, he's all kinds of things.
Right.
He's got complete control. He's the Burroughs guy.
Yeah.
And... But he would work with Burroughs, and particularly on Cities of the Dead Night. I mean, Burroughs cut it up so much that it was really very, very hard to follow the stories. It's basically two narratives which merge and finish up as one single narrative. But the way Bill did it was very sloppy, and he just had the one manuscript on one side and the other, and he just would feed them one page into the other. There was no attempt to end one at the end of a sentence and,
right.
you know, put in a sensible break.
The ultimate cut-up.
Yeah. So Grauholtz went through and tried to cut them in more or less the same places, but, you know, finish off each little section and then move on to the other pile and so on.
Right. I mean, this is
so that kind of thing happened endlessly.
Right. Well, you describe in terms of the writing of Naked Lunch, he'd scrawl notes on a piece of TypeScript and he'd throw it over his shoulder onto the floor, mm-hmm. and the pages would be all over the place, and various helpers, whoever they were, Geisen or Ginsberg, whatever, would be putting the pages together and trying to make some kind of order out of it.
I mean, a lot of it was written in Tangier,
right.
and it would just blow out into the garden of the hotel he was living in, and the cats would shit on it, and, you know.
I want to talk about, you know, one of the points that you make throughout the book that I know was a point that he made also was that, you know, he was affiliated with a lot of countercultural movements, beginning with the Beats, obviously, all the way up through the punks, was, you know, commonly labeled in the media as the godfather of punk.
Mm-hmm.
He rejected all of those labels himself in many ways. And I think, you know, you make a convincing case. I agree with that in the book, those are ways of just sort of putting him in a box that he didn't exactly fit. One of the most interesting things about him is that he really didn't fit into any boxes. He sort of knew everyone, but was his own entity. Why do you think why do you think there's this attempt to box him up so much?
When he came back to the States in 74, I think he pretty quickly realized that he needed to be something of a celebrity in order to sell books. Also, he was quite broke at that point because he'd stopped receiving the money from his parents in 1964, because by then he actually was selling a lot of copies of books, and Naked Lunch was out in a lot of languages. And he was living a wealthy life in the best part of London, you know, all the rest of it. But by the time he got to New York, sales had dropped off some, and he was taking a lot of drugs, which was costing him a lot of money, and more money than was coming in. So he made, a fairly conscious decision to play the celebrity game. And whereas in 1958, he'd pretty much rejected Kerouac because he just thought that he had betrayed his friends so much, particularly
Ginsberg.
Well,
there was that famous break, right, where Kerouac's mother wrote a letter to Ginsberg saying, essentially, you're a pervert and I don't want you to have anything to do with my son.
Mm-hmm.
And Kerouac defended her. Right?
That's right.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. And Bill just said, this is not the action of any kind of friend. Or, you know, any kind of meaningful friendship, you know, is over. So he only saw him once very briefly after that, and didn't correspond with him at all after that. But when he came back to the States, of course, you know, it made sense to be an old friend of Jack's, of course, and the Beat Generation was resurrected and sort of brushed off and became a brand, let's face it. It was a brand created by Allen Ginsberg, one of the master you know, manipulators of
of
image.
Another great advertising man.
Well, he did start off. Alan started off as an advertising man. Of course. Right. He worked in the Empire State.
I have a friend who used to call him the man in the gray flannel beret.
That's very good.
but
Alan was a tremendous promoter of his friends. Yeah. I mean, he worked tirelessly to get them all published, and he was convinced that they were all geniuses. And in some cases, they even were.
Yeah. And then the readings became a part of that. I mean, he started doing the readings in the mid-late 70s as a way of selling books, but also as a way of sort of promoting that persona, right? I mean, in some ways, it seems to me that the persona that we now have when we listen to the audio in a few minutes, that persona, the sort of, I always think of him as kind of my cranky Uncle Bill, right? That is a kind of construction of that public moment, of seizing that public.
It is to a degree, I mean, he had done a quite a lot of performance work in Europe before he came back to the States, but it was 60s stuff. It was just after Happenings, and it would be usually a multimedia event of some sort with in a film playing on him and people painting in the background, and sometimes the audience subjected to extremely loud cut-up tapes of pneumatic drills and radio static and stuff. And he could really clear a room fast, actually, if he wanted to. And but when he started to tour here, I mean, it was much more of a professional job to make money. James Grauholtz had previously done a lot of touring as a rock and roll band. Right. Never that successful, but enough for him to know how to do it. And when Burroughs first came back, he did some teaching, but he hated it because he got no feedback from the students, and it gave him a writer's block. And he really didn't want to go in that direction. So James had this great idea: why don't you just go out on the road and read your stuff? And he did maybe 200 readings over a period of years. And it became extremely good at it. He got his act down really well. He knew how to wait until the audience stopped applauding and before he'd said the next line and all that kind of thing, and became very, very professional and got it down, actually. I mean, sometimes he always felt that he needed a few drinks, mind you, before he went on, and just occasionally he got a bit too loose. But
but he also and he was great at selecting the material. So there were obviously things that were going to go over well in front of an audience. It was in a way a kind of heightened stand-up, certainly. I mean, he went for the
there was a side of him which was real sort of W.C. Fields, really.
Yes, yeah.
And he sounded a bit like him. And certainly,
actually,
the voice is what's so amazing about Burroughs, because it's almost like listening to somebody from before the war. He's got that, some of the timbre of his voice is like a pre-war recordings you hear in radio shots. And also, it's the mixture of rather, classically trained, Harvard-educated, classical references, all mixed up with sort of 40s junkie slang. And it's quite
Black,
a unique sound.
Hobo stuff.
Yeah,
Bindlestiffs, and, right? I mean, all of those sort of books he discovered as a kid. I mean, he discovered You Can't Win as a teenager.
The story, autobiography of a petty thief.
Right.
And, he adored that book. I mean, he memorized it without realizing it. So later on, when he was writing Naked Lunch, in fact, all these characters like Pantapon Rose and I've forgotten who they all are now. But anyway, he was astonished to find that that's where they all came from. They weren't his own creations at all. He lifted them from somebody else's book. The same thing happened later on in the final trilogy with Denton Welsh.
Right.
He suddenly found that he was writing virtually entire sentences, which came out of a book he read back in the 20s or something, or 30s.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, it is his centennial, his 100th birthday is on Wednesday. I was reading recently, someone said in some piece of writing about him I read, and I said he appeared, he looked like he was 100 years old when he was 30. in fact, actually, one of the most astonishing things that I found in this book is his Harvard, you reproduce his Harvard student ID photo where he actually does look like a 21-year-old, and I thought, man, I guess he really was young at one. But it seems both an obvious trope and also something worth our looking at. What we talked a little bit about it in terms of the language and control question, but how do you assess his legacy?
Well, that's always a tricky one. Obviously, he's influenced literature. I mean, J.G. Ballard, for instance, always said that he you know, his writing would have been entirely different had he not first read Burroughs. Will Self is an obvious one. William Gibson said that cyberpunk wouldn't exist without Burroughs. So there is a strain of literature, particularly American literature, which comes directly from him. And also the Beats in general. I think the fact that Burroughs was involved in the last obscenity case, so after the trial of Naked Lunch in Boston, there were no more obscenity trials for literature in America. So in that respect, you can now write about anything, no matter how creepy and embarrassing and obscene it might be. You can put it in print and no one's going to bust you. So, you know, which is wonderful. You know, it opened up, it basically opened up the whole field of literature so that you could just express yourself completely without worries anymore. But it wasn't entirely him. I mean, but it was that group of people, I think, pushed for
no,
that.
No, I think as we were, you know, he was sort of the extreme end in some way. I mean, if you think about the progression, the Grove progression, you know, with Lady Chatterley and then Tropic of Cancer, and there's some other books thrown in, Kane's book perhaps.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But then,
and then John Retchie and all those
John
people.
John Retchie.
Now, Grove was an astonishing press in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, really sort of actively pursuing that kind of work. But Naked Lunch really takes it to the farthest. If you can make the case that Naked Lunch has social redeeming value, which I think it does, then you can really make the case for pretty much anything having
social value. That's right. Yeah, that's true.
And true. We'll talk about that in a second, but I think it absolutely does. It opens up the field of what literature is and what you know, how wide intellectual and cultural life can go. Mm. Right. So.
And I think beyond that, I mean, he extended out into other genre, into rock and roll. An awful lot of musicians took their inspiration from him, or like Steely Dan got their name from him, and a lot of English bands, Soft Machine. took their name from him. Iggy Pop quotes, you know, talks about Burroughs in some of his early stuff. Right, right across the board, really. He knew Paul McCartney quite well in 1965 and discussed cut-ups with him a lot. In the end, Paul decided to leave the cut-ups to Burroughs, but he put him on the cover of Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, so, and actually, that's an interesting thing, too, that he and McCartney, I mean, he and Ian Somerville were using Ringo Starr's apartment.
That's right, yeah, Montague Square.
As a studio to make their cut-up experiments. It was where, and they were also watching as McCartney wrote and developed Eleanor Rigby.
That's it.
Which is a kind of, if you think about those, that's a really fascinating juxtaposition between Eleanor Rigby on the one hand and Towers Open Fire on the other.
They're not things you would naturally associate. But then the film performance, for instance, Nick Rogue's film, you know, the Mick Jagger film, which is a very good sort of film about that period in London, quite literally uses the cut-up technique. Nick Rogue came to see Anthony Balch, who did the cut-up films of Cut-Up and Towers Open Fire, and asked him how it was done, and just literally did the same thing. And he took a group of outtakes of Jagger, that literally cutting room floor stuff, and just randomly dropped it in at the beginning of the film, and in about five or six, they're quite quick. Right. Flashbacks or flash, whatever they are, flash forwards. But so his impact is right across. I mean, there's all sorts of references to Burroughs in cult films of various sorts, and I think cut-ups in general have probably influenced you know, the way films are made, you know, and advertisements, and particularly rock and roll videos, the sort of jump cuts and this very fast cutting, which didn't used to be the case. I mean, films used to be much, much slower. And well, how much Burroughs had to do with it, I really don't know. But he was part of the, it was in the air, I think.
It was, yeah. But I also think, I mean, one of the interesting things about those books, and again, particularly about this question of control, is how much I think they, and I do think it was him reading his moment and seeing the seeds of that moment was. The seeds of our moment are in that moment. But this idea, you know, we don't often think of him as a political writer, but yet some of the stuff in Naked Lunch about torture and the use of torture as a control mechanism, or the use of threats of torture as a control mechanism, seemed to me to be right out of Abu Ghraib playbook in some ways. And, you know, there is this sense of real political prescience, I think, that sense of America as a very complicated legacy.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, the job, for instance, is almost entirely filled with essays on different ways of combating control. in some of them pretty bizarre. But so it is, you know, it's a book of political essays. Yeah. It's astonishing. I mean, he never really agreed with Ginsberg in politically in that respect, because Allen was always very much love and peace and giving flowers to policemen. And as right. Burroughs said, the only way he would like to see a policeman given a flower is in a flower pot from a high window. So there's quite a difference there. Right. And he was, you know, very cheered by the riots in Chicago and in Paris in May 68 and all of that. I mean, he really thought... He thought that society was so controlled that the only way out really was through rioting and radical changes. I mean, he really believed that you had to behave badly. You had to really do something which cracked the whole thing apart, and only then could it be remade in a better way. I mean, he didn't believe in gradual change, at least not in the 60s. I mean, like most of us, I mean, his opinions moved and changed.
Right.
But he was on the radical side in the 60s very much. I mean, he was always changing. I mean, wherever Burroughs lived, he had a virtually entirely different set of, not only outfits, but ideas as well,
right.
According to where he was and who he was seeing.
Yeah. What do you think his lasting, you know, as far, again, just on the legacy question, as far as the work goes, do you think it really is Naked Lunch? Do you think it's stuff like, we were talking about The Soft Machine or...
Well, all of the cut-up trilogy is about to be reissued by Grove, or maybe they're out already. Oliver Harris has done apparently a really great job on editing them, which wouldn't surprise me because he's a very, very good Burroughs scholar. So I'm hoping that the cut-up stuff will influence people. Maybe people will return to it. As long as you regard it as prose poetry and just dip into it and take what you can from it as just as if you were reading a poem, then it's fine. Don't look for narrative. I mean, you won't find it.
It's the dream logic, I think, in many ways. It's mm-hmm. you know, that's how I've always sort of worked into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like I'm participating in somebody's dream, and I stay as long as I can.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, his very last major book, I mean, The Western Lands, I think, holds up very, very well,
I
actually.
Do too. Yeah.
There's a lot of good books there. I mean, obviously, like anyone's output, they're uneven. But at the moment... The whole lot are in print, as far as I know, and they're in print in a very large number of languages. So clearly he was doing something right, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting move, as we sort of were hinting at, from the very experimental work at the beginning of his career to that kind of more, I hesitate to call any of it more mainstream, but that more narratively focused work that he sort of, as an artist, he moved through phases as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he... The one he was a bit worried about was his book about cats, The Cat Inside, which he thought might be bordering on the mawkish, and it is, actually, to be quite honest. Because in his old age, he was living in his little cottage in Lawrence, Kansas, and had his five cats, who, each one of which had a diet of its own. Although, you know, of course, they moved around each other's bowls all the time. They were all overweight.
Right.
He spent hours every day fussing with his cats
and
taking his drugs and doing his paintings. And
Not a bad way to spend your dotage, right?
No.
There's so much we haven't talked about. I keep talking, but I do want to hear, I think we should hear a little bit of Mr. Burroughs' Thanksgiving Prayer from 1986. We'll just hear the opening part of it just to have his voice as part of the conversation. And then when that is over, we will open it up to questions from the floor. So if you have questions...
For John Dillinger, and hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and the passenger pigeons destined to be shit out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream to vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK, for nigger killing low men feed in their notches, for decent church going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for killing queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for laboratory AIDS. Thanks for prohibition and the war against drugs.
William S. Burroughs, happy birthday, Mr.
Happy birthday, Bill, yes.
All right, so we have some time for some questions from the floor. If you stick up your hand, we will come around with a microphone. Wait for the microphone.
Thank you, Barry, for all your books, especially Frank Zappa also. The hidden ground of Bill may be James Joyce, but it's probably more Wyndham Lewis, who said, artists live in the present and write a detailed history of the future. How could you relate that to the fact that Bill hawked Nike tennis shoes on a TV commercial spouting McLuhanisms?
He needed the money. I mean, as he said, everybody else has got jobs. All these people who are criticizing me, you know, they go out to work and earn money. I mean, he needed money. And if you remember, I mean, he doesn't actually mention Nike in the ad. He just, you know, I don't know where they recorded it. He only appears in a little TV monitor in the actual ad. As far as I know, you know, the ad didn't sell any more shoes than normal. Probably put people off, actually.
In the 70s, the Bowery was a very, very rough place. Why did he decide to live there? Was it for the money? And then why did he move to Lawrence, Kansas?
Well, he moved into the 222 Bowery because John Giorno was living there, and several other friends of his had lofts there. Also, it was very cheap at the time, and he had a very large loft. It was the locker room or the gym and locker room of the old YMCA. So if you went into the bathroom there would be a row of sinks and a row of urinals, and by one of the sinks was this little jelly jar with his toothbrush in it. And it was perfect for him. I mean, you know, the ghosts of all these boys, you know, and all that were all like echoing around the place. And there was no windows. It was just this huge concrete space with a fridge that hummed. So the whole, it was a weird kind of atmosphere in there. And although he put one or two pictures up on the wall, it was basically a workspace. And he stayed there for a good long time. It became a very much a social center for a lot of sort of artistic gangsters and junkies in New York. And eventually the landlord doubled the rent, and he had to get out, basically. By then, he was taking too many drugs. He had hardly any money, and he finally reached the end of that sort of phase, I think. And he was very good at identifying the time to move. And when he moved, he just pretty much cut himself off from the previous scene and took on almost a new identity. So he went from New York to Kansas, where he bought a small house with an acre in the backyard there. And he could go and shoot his guns out in just outside the city limits at a friend's place. And finally settled down. He lived there for 16 years. He had a garage he could paint in. He had his cats, as I was saying. And he'd reached old age. It was time to, you know, that heavy New York scene, and it was a heavy vibe in the 70s and early 80s. I mean, he was too old for it, and he'd had enough of it. I think he just got tired, you know.
And people left him alone there. He was a Midwesterner as well, so I think that
it was a full circle. He'd gone back to the Midwest, yeah. And he liked the people. James Grolholtz had actually moved to Lawrence earlier, two or three years earlier, and moved William Burroughs Communications out there, and was running all of his office from there, you know, arranging all the reading tours and foreign translations and all of that stuff. So he would go out there and visit him, and he liked the place. It was it's like a little island of liberality in Kansas, and there was a circle of friends he could just drop straight into. There was the usual support system, which he needed, so people would come in. There was a roster of young men who would come and cook his dinner for him, and people would come in every 2, you know, 3 days and clean the place. It was ideal. You know, it was a great deal better than the life he had on the Bowery, you know, where he was having to go to the methadone clinic and, you know, hang out with... Well, it was a very dangerous life he was living there. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's a miracle he didn't catch AIDS, for instance, because he was shooting up with a whole bunch of junkies, who, most of whom did come down with it in the end. I mean, he was lucky.
What do you think of the Dada artists, and specifically Kurt Schwitters, in regard to... I'm a big believer that there's nothing that's original. It's just appropriation mm-hmm. and recycling. The cut-up method, as employed by Schwitters and Picabia to a lesser degree, did it influence?
But particularly Schwitters. You know, the earlier collages of Schwitters are very similar to Burroughs' collages. Yeah, he was definitely influenced by him. Most of his art influences came via Brian Gysin, but Gysin was very aware of all of that material, having been, you know, almost a member of the Surrealist group at one point. You know, he knew Duchamp and all those people and Breton. So built in a sort of straight lineage from all of those people, and he knew all about Tristan Zara pulling all the, you know, the poems out of a hat and all that stuff. So yeah, like you say, there is nothing new. No, he just. He did it with a little Burroughs spin on it. You know.
Did William Burroughs have any kind of opinion or communication with George Carlin?
That I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know.
I could see them liking each other. Or
yeah,
not, or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a... Any over there? Did you ever have...
Well, in his time in Mexico, did he meet any Latin American literature writers or writers?
He did speak Spanish, but I don't think he knew too many people. He stayed very much in his little expatriate community. The same in Tangier, which was mainly Spanish speaking. The sort of circles he moved in, you know, many of the of his boyfriends would be Spanish, but he didn't really know any of the writers. Some of the Moroccan writers later on criticized him quite heavily for, you know, for his, you know, the way basically exploiting the, you know, the poverty there as a sort of sex tourist, and I mean it's a sort of ongoing discussion in Europe anyway that you know, why didn't Paul Bowles, for instance, teach all of these young men to read? You know, some of them he knew, you know, for 10 years or more, and he would tape their stories, but he never ever showed them how to write, you know, read and write. There's a whole argument there of exploitation, and it's a complicated business. But Burroughs is just as guilty as the others, and he recognized that. I mean, he was... I think he would have enjoyed knowing people. I mean, he knew Hamri and a few people in Morocco who were painters, but as far as I know, not in Mexico City. I don't think he knew anybody there. No, not even the intelligentsia in Chile or in anywhere. No, he didn't. Ginsberg did, but not Bill.
Could you talk a little about Burroughs' history with heroin?
Well, that goes back to 1944, I guess, when he was very... intrigued and fascinated by low life, basically petty criminals and junkies and everyone who came from such a utterly different background as himself, and he was at one point trying to shift some stolen goods, which included a number of packages of morphine syrettes that had been stolen, probably off of a boat from the you know, the medical kit in lifeboats. And a friend of his, another sort of low-life type, introduced him to a guy called Herbert Hunky and a guy called Phil the Sailor, and who were both users. And it was through that connection. He sold them the morphine, but he kept a few back for himself to try them out. Then, of course, after he tried them out, he went and had to buy a few from them at a higher price. And then it went round and round. He was... I mean, after he graduated Harvard, he did study anthropology, and he had a one side of him at least was definitely experimenting, and he would literally try out all these different drugs with a purpose, not just to get high, but also to see what it was like. And he basically liked heroin and all of its derivatives. And I remember when he was at the bunker, a really massive amount of opium came along, and a friend of his gave him a big ball of it. And he loved the whole idea. I mean, he never saw anything morally reprehensible about taking drugs. He knew that at some point he would have to come down, you know, have withdrawal. But I think he actually enjoyed the withdrawal symptoms even, because they put him into a very nostalgic frame of mind. And although he was suffering, he also used to have these memories and nostalgic sort of feelings about St. Louis and, you know, the sound of the distant railroad whistles and music drifting down a windy street and papers blowing and lying with his mother in bed and seeing the car lights through the window moving across the ceiling. All of that sort of nostalgia was brought on by withdrawal. So basically, I mean, his whole life was dedicated to trying out and experimenting with different states of mind. And experimenting, you know, in the old Rambo thing of you know, he really did try and change his perceptions all the time. So heroin and morphine, you know, on and off from 1945 right through to 97.
How in the world did William Burroughs get interested in Scientology?
Well, you'd have to blame Brian Geisen for that, I'm afraid, who introduced him to it in late 59, early 60. And to him, it was yet another way of looking at control systems. And
he always mind expansion, too, in a way, right?
And mind expansion. And he really did think that it would enable him to analyze whatever blockages he had and wherever this ugly spirit resided. I mean, none of his friends could understand why he stuck with it so long, and it was very detrimental to his life, particularly with Ian Somerville, who was really the only boyfriend he had who he really cared for, and the only long-term gay relationship that he had, because Ian couldn't stand any of that and refused to allow him to even talk about it. And there were a number of occasions when they could have gotten back together, and Bill always blew it with his Scientology and fixing him with his operating thetan gaze, you know. And so, and then, but again, you see, this is one another example of Bill changing his personality. I mean, he was really obsessed with this, and he really alienated an awful lot of his friends in London. And then he moved to New York, and you never heard a peep about Scientology, you know. He got rid of all his books, he got rid of his e-meter. That was the end of that. And then there was a new Bill in New York. But, it wasted 10 years of his life, maybe more, 15 years.
I was just wondering, did you always know that you were going to write this book, or what was it that made you decide to write it?
Oh, I've always been really obsessed with the Beats, I guess, you know. I went to art college in 1959 until 63, and the Beat Generation were the only Bohemians around. I mean, you look back to Paris in the 20s or something, but all those people were gone, and also separated culturally by a war, whereas the Beats were around. I mean, they were older than me, obviously, but they were doing the kind of things I was interested in. You know, and it was that notion of, you know, the starving artist in the garret and people taking drugs and behaving badly. And Burroughs was the coolest of them all, because he was the, you know, to a 17-year-old, like as I was, there's this guy who takes drugs, he's like a, you know, he's gay, he's killed his wife, I mean, all these things. To a teenager, you know, it sounds incredibly romantic.
He was the most extreme.
Yeah,
that's why he was the most. I was drawn to him also, because he was the baddest ass, right? He was the baddest of the bad asses.
Yeah. When after I met him, I've worked with all the Beats. I mean, I worked with Allen Ginsberg a lot, and he always used to stay with me when he came to London. And I edited the revised text edition of Howl, or the whatever it was called, Variorum edition of of Howell. And I lived on his farm for a while, and he and I and my girlfriend lived in a hippie commune in Berkeley, in fact, for about 7 months. We had a whole floor there. So I've always been very intrigued by the American beats. And it's fortunate, because I knew through Ginsberg in the 60s and 70s, I met all these other characters who are now dead. So I knew Lucian Carr, and I knew Carl Solomon, and all of them. And so when I came to write this book, I'd already interviewed them for the biography I did on Ginsberg back in 1984, or began writing in 1984. And I had a lot of background material that I was able to draw upon. And I've written a lot about them. I mean, there's a book on the Beat Hotel I wrote, and a little book on Kerouac, and an earlier book on Burroughs. And also, I did the bibliography of Burroughs for the University of Virginia Bibliographical Society. And I produced a 3-CD box set of his cut-up tapes, which, as I said earlier, they're guaranteed to clear a room. If you have too many have people left over after a dinner party, you can't get rid of them. You know, put on one of Bill's tapes. And
Right, we have time for one more question.
Curious about his level of participation in the Naked Lunch movie, and if it was another just economic necessity, or how he ultimately felt about how it turned out.
He didn't like it at all. It was the money, again. I mean, he liked Cronenberg, and he liked his ideas, and he liked some of the ideas that he developed, you know, the talking typewriters and all that stuff, which is not in Naked Lunch, of course. He was very pleased that Cronenberg didn't ask him to take any part in writing the script or working on the script. It was basically just another thing, you know, that he got, I think, $350,000 or something, which he needed at the time. And he really disliked the way that it was based very much on his own lifestyle, a life story. The death of Joan occurs in it, I think, twice, not just once, but twice. Of course, that's not in Naked Lunch either. I mean, it's just called The Naked Lunch. It's nothing to do with the book, really, at all. So ultimately, at the time, he had to go and publicize it because that was part of the contract. And he did his usual fudging, you know, of everything, and seemed like he liked it, but you know, who knows? But really, he didn't. He was the stuff about Joan really he disliked very much, and was offended by, actually.
Thank you, Barry.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you all for coming.
And thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.